The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Sitting on a bar stool, kind of short and kind of square, through the foam in his mustache, his voice fills the air. Talking about a state of mind, son. Talking about the state of Jefferson. It's a wave on a dusty road. It's a logger's heavy load. It's a cattle on the hill. It's a range full of thrills. It's a way of life. Settles in your soul.
In your soul. Good morning, Jefferson, everybody in the North State, all 23 declared counties. I want to say good morning and happy Sunday to everybody. My partner in crime, Terry, is out on assignment, and he's going to have a good report for us next week when he gets back and tell us what he was doing and where he was. It should be very good. Okay, I want to let everybody know we're going to be talking to Mark Baird in just a second. He's on the line, and we're going to be... Well, let's just pull Mark on real quick, and we'll get that started, if you would, Liam. Mark, are you there?
I am here. How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing well. How about you, brother?
Oh, every day is a blessing.
Amen. Amen. Hey, we hear that there's some great success in what's going on with the Second Amendment case that you've got going against California with Bonta, so it's Baird versus Bonta, and there was a pretty good video that was put out. How about if we take a listen to that, and then afterwards we can talk about it? You game for that?
Yeah, sounds good.
Okay, folks, just so you know, it's about 13 minutes, 49 seconds long, but it's very well worth the listen. So here we go.
A couple weeks ago in a case called Baird versus Bonta, the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit based in California issued a major ruling dealing with open carrying of firearms. But it's not huge for the reason that's been reported on. It's extra huge for the Second Amendment in a way that hasn't been talked about narrowly enough, if at all. I want to explain to you why this Ninth Circuit ruling is going to be a very big deal for gun owners in California very soon. You'll see why when we get back and talk about it. Hey folks, I'm Mark Smith, host of the Four Box of Diner, proud American gun owner, constitutional attorney, member of the United States Supreme Court Bar, and author of First They Came for the Gun Owners, the A to Z guide about how the anti-gunners intend to take away our rights if we let them do it, which I know we won't. All right, folks, so a couple weeks ago, you probably read about this case out of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in California called Mark Baird and Richard Gallardo versus Bonta. This is a challenge, a constitutional challenge under the Second Amendment to California's criminal law dealing with the unlicensed open carry of handguns. There was a lawsuit brought claiming that this violated the Second Amendment. The federal trial court, which is the United States District Court, denied the injunction and basically did a backdoor tiers of scrutiny balancing of the interest, good and bad on guns, and has simply said that because the government has an interest in stopping gun violence, guess what? The Second Amendment doesn't matter that much. And the motion for a preliminary injunction on behalf of the plaintiff was denied. So the plaintiff took this appeal, immediate appeal, to the Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. I'm happy to report, and this is the headline news, and then I'm going to get into the geeky news, which is much more important than the headlines. The headline news is the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals reversed the district court and said that the district court failed to do the proper analysis of a preliminary injunction for Second Amendment cases and reversed the denial of the motion for a preliminary injunction and sent the case back to the district court for further findings and for a redo of the motion for a preliminary injunction and told them to redo it. So that is big news in and of itself. And the headline was in all the newspapers that the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has reversed a district court denial of motion for a preliminary injunction and sent it back for further information, findings, and conclusions and analysis. That was the headline. But let me tell you why this case is really important. and why it's going to have a ripple effect on all the cases in California, all the gun control challenges in California in federal court, and in all the constitutional claim cases out of the Ninth Circuit in its entirety. It's because of the standard, not of the Second Amendment, but the standard it set forth for preliminary injunctions. Specifically, to get an injunction, four elements have to be satisfied. The first is that the plaintiff, in our situation, in our world, the Second Amendment plaintiff's challenging a gun control law, the plaintiff has to be likely to succeed on the merits, likelihood of success on the merits, meaning that the claim against the gun control law is likely to succeed. That's the first element. The second one is that there's irreparable harm, which inevitably there is. If you're likely to have your constitutional rights violated, then by definition that constitutes irreparable harm under longstanding Supreme Court precedent. So if you win on likelihood of success on the merits, you basically also win on irreparable harm. So the two other elements of the four elements for a preliminary injunction, in addition to likelihood of success on the merits plus irreparable harm to the plaintiff, if the injunction is not granted or given, is a balance of the equities, kind of the good and the bad, as well as the public interest. Well, the Supreme Court and other courts have said repeatedly that governments have no interest at all to be balanced if they're violating a constitutional right of an American. So once a plaintiff arguing that his Second Amendment rights have been violated, once the plaintiff shows he's likely to succeed on the merits, he wins really the injunction for all intents and purposes. Because once you make that conclusion, the court makes that conclusion, he's viewed to have suffered or will suffer irreparable harm without an injunction. The balance of the equities only can weigh in his favor because the government has no interest at all in enforcing an unconstitutional law, nor does the public have an interest in having an unconstitutional law enforced. So do you see, given those four factors for a preliminary injunction, the really, at the end of the day, the whole ball of wax is whether or not a court concludes that a Second Amendment plaintiff is likely to succeed on the merits, and that it is likely the case that the modern gun control law being challenged is unconstitutional under the Second Amendment and its jurisprudence, including Heller and Bruin and Catano. All right, so why is all of this important? And why is this Baird versus Bonta case important? You see, what happened is, and I've been warning about this before, and in some of my speeches and lectures, even to the Federalist Society, I think I've talked about this. What we have to be careful of in the Second Amendment community, and what judges have to be careful of, is allowing tiers of scrutiny or interest balancing of the good and the bad of guns to sneak in through the back door in some ways. Because the Supreme Court in Nicerpa versus Bruin made very clear, and they also did it in Heller as well, but they made it extra clear in Bruin, that interest balancing, tiers of scrutiny, strict scrutiny, intermediate scrutiny, all these kinds of good and bad, you know, you weigh the government interest on the one hand against the interest of the gun owner on the other hand, and you balance it all out. The Supreme Court says this is totally verboten. This is not allowed. It's prohibited. There's no excuse for violating the constitutional right. You can't balance it away. And that's why I've always said on this channel, no matter who says otherwise, even if you think they're good on guns, do not believe them. If anyone tries to say tiers of scrutiny is a good idea, or balancing the interest or interest balancing involving the Second Amendment and a right to keep and bear arms, you tell them, go pound sand. They're 100% wrong, and I don't care who tells you that. That is wrong. You don't want that. And the good news is that the Ninth Circuit, in setting the guidelines going forward for all Second Amendment cases in the Ninth Circuit, which is all the Hawaii cases, by the way, all the Arizona, all the Washington State cases, all the California cases, those states sound familiar to you? A lot of them are anti-gunner states. Yes, indeed. The standard is that you laser focus on likelihood of success on the merits. That is where the whole fight is to take place. That is what the Ninth Circuit said. And they specifically said going forward in Second Amendment cases, that must be done first. Likelihood of success on the merits. Let me read to you what the Ninth Circuit has said. Remember, this is the law that is going to be applied to among not just Ninth Circuit judges, but lower court judges in the district courts like Judge Benitez, this is the law that's going to be applied, and it's very good for us on preliminary injunction matters. The Ninth Circuit wrote in the Baird case, as noted, the likelihood of success on the merits is a particularly important consideration in the preliminary injunction analysis of a constitutional claim, because a finding that the plaintiff is likely to succeed on the merits of such a claim sharply tilts in the plaintiff's favor both the irreparable harm factor and the merged public interest and balance of harms factors. Consequently, a plaintiff who can show that a statute likely violates the Constitution will also show that both the public interest and the balance of equities favor a preliminary injunction. The court goes on to say, and this is huge, huge, because remember, this is the law that's going to be applied in future Second Amendment cases from this moment forward. So although I support open carry of firearms in California, and that is the headline issue, that the open carrying of firearms is being litigated right now in California, and I wish them Godspeed. But the real exciting news is this geeky inside baseball change of the standard or emphasis on the standard on the likelihood of success on the merits, because it does two things. One is it forces the courts to do the NYSERPA versus Bruin methodology, which is very good for us because it shifts the burden to the government to come forth with historical analogs from 1791, which is very difficult to do because in 1791 there are very few gun control related laws. And the other huge thing that helps us out in the Second Amendment community is it really shuts down the opportunity for lower courts to abuse and sneak in the back way tiers of scrutiny or interest balancing by claiming, oh, well, we're not going to look at likelihood of success on the merits first. We're going to go the back door and we're going to check out the balance of the equities and public interest and stuff like that first to see, no. The Ninth Circuit says, no. You start with likelihood of success on the merits. You don't talk about any of these other issues until you do that first. That's great news for us. So the court again says, notwithstanding the settled interplay between the factors, the district court here declined to undertake any inquiry into the plaintiff's likelihood of success on the merits of their Second Amendment challenge to these California laws. Instead, the district court conducted only a merged analysis of the third and fourth factors of the preliminary injunction standard and proceeded to deny the injunction after concluding that because the public interest and balance of harms disfavored the issuance of a preliminary injunction, it was not necessary to assess applicants, meaning the plaintiffs, likelihood of success on the merit. This was an error. In a case presenting a constitutional claim, it is always necessary for a district court to determine whether the plaintiff is likely to succeed on the merits because of the influence such a finding has on the other preliminary injunction standards and factors. Put otherwise, a federal district trial court that skips over analyzing the first factor where the plaintiff alleges a constitutional violation cannot properly evaluate the other factors. Then the Ninth Circuit says, here in this case dealing with the open carrying of firearms in California and the constitutional challenge under the Second Amendment to California's ban on the open carrying of firearms, and you go to prison if you open carry without a license, the Ninth Circuit says, quote, by denying the plaintiff's motion to enjoin California's general open carry ban based solely on his conclusion that the public interest weighed against plaintiffs, the federal trial court or the district court thus employed an incorrect legal standard for the issuance of a preliminary injunction and therefore abused its discretion. Period, full stop, bang, bang. That is a geeky detail that you learn here on the Four Boxes Diner. But this alteration of the standard for a preliminary injunction in the Ninth Circuit dealing with constitutional claims, including claims under the Second Amendment's right to keep arms, is a huge deal. This ripple effect is not just going to affect the Baird case involving the open carrying of firearms and the fact that it's been banned in California and it's a crime if you do it. This change of the standard is going to have a ripple effect in all cases in the Ninth Circuit, and not just at the Court of Appeals level, but at the federal trial court level in all these critical anti-gun states of Hawaii, California, Washington, and so on. So again, this Baird versus Bonta case, we have to watch very carefully, not just because of the open carry issue and the carrying of guns issue and outside the home for self-defense in public and so on, but also because of this change in the standard or emphasis in the standard in Second Amendment claims on dealing with preliminary injunctions, which, of course, happens all the time. Preliminary injunctions occur all the time in Second Amendment litigation. It is a big deal. And if you win the preliminary injunction, that usually tells you and tells everyone that you're likely going to win the permanent injunction because you're on the right path to victory. So, all right, folks, I hope you did not find this too geeky here today at the Four Boxes Diner, but I hope you learned something. And again, if you haven't subscribed on at Twitter, at Four Boxes Diner, please do so. And don't forget to subscribe and like this video. It makes a big difference in distributing my videos out there to the Second Amendment community. So if you haven't subscribed, please do so. And we'll see you again soon here at the Four Boxes Diner.
All right. Well, thank you, Liam, for playing that. Mark, what do you think?
Well, I mean, that's it, isn't it, in a nutshell. And the abuse of discretion by federal court has been going on for 5 years. This, you know, this is not the first time I've been in front of this judge, as you know, and as the people of Jefferson know. This was the judge that denied us the standing to get the state of Jefferson when, right after that, about a year later, Election Integrity gained standing in a very similar way from a different judge in the federal circuit. So this judge is absolutely in ignorance of the law, or I think it's willful ignorance myself. I think she knows exactly what she's doing. And also in the Ninth Circuit opinion, it also says that the judge shouldn't be doing the state's job, which she does regularly. She's a better attorney for the state than the state's attorney. In fact, the state's attorney is kind of a buffoon. He just sits there and waits for the judge to tell him what he should say and what he should do. And then he says, oh, yeah, Your Honor, yeah, yeah, that's you're right, that's it. Yeah, that's what we want. I mean, and so...
Is that because he knows that they've got a losing battle?
Well, you know, I don't know what they know for sure. I think in their arrogance, they think they win everything because they're the state.
Okay.
And that is the definition of tyranny, isn't it? When the state says something, we want this because we want it, and you all will suffer with it because we want it. Isn't that the definition of tyranny?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, because is it not the state's job to uphold, to support, and defend the Constitution? Is it not the trial court's job to defend the Constitution? Isn't that the goal? Isn't justice, in the end, the affirmation that you'll support and defend the Constitution, because that is the will of the people. That is the will of the people supported by the government that the people created. And the Bill of Rights isn't just some vapid, illusory thing that, oh, yeah, it looks good on paper, but courts and governments can ignore it anytime they want to. At least that's not the way I view it. Yet that's what this judge has consistently done, and she finally got spanked by the Ninth Circuit for doing it.
So what's your thought on, and I don't know if it's a wild guess or if there's something written down on timeline or whatever, but what does it look like as far as how long it's going to take for this to be addressed and fixed, if you will?
Well, the court instructed her to do this in an expeditious manner because we've been waiting almost 5 years for a ruling on this, a correct ruling. And she has ruled incorrectly time and time again, according to the Ninth Circuit Court, and they have ordered her to expeditiously correct this error. Well, now the court had the opportunity, and they presented two cases to her. They presented a case that where the circuit court reversed themselves in 10 days, and that's, of course, the case we would want to lean on, and then they presented a case where it took 60 days. Now, that's not what we want, But you know what happens whenever you lay something on the table for these people, they're going to latch on to the one that's most beneficial to their cause. Now, remember, you have to remember throughout all of this, that Judge Mueller's cause is not justice. Judge Mueller's cause is tyranny and the restriction of rights and the deprivation of rights of the people of the state of California and in all the Ninth Circuit from constitutional guarantees. That is her cause. That's been her cause all along. She adheres to state dicta and state doctrine. She's a dyed-in-the-wool Democratic operative. That's no secret. And if you have been even to even one of these court hearings, you can see it. It's as plain as the nose on your face. So the open question is Judge Mueller more worried about her standing as the chief magistrate for California's Eastern District, God forbid, or is she more worried about her standing in the wine bar as being a good communist socialist Democrat? What is she worried about most? Because that's going to define her forward behavior.
Yeah, probably the latter.
Our next hearing is November 3rd, and that would be for the summary judgment hearing. Clearly, the state should not win that. You know, they have, between the last hearing and this one, they engaged four more experts, the three of whom they've used before. So in the first try, three of their experts failed to make the case, and the Ninth Circuit made a comment on that in the oral. The state said something, and Judge Van Dyke said, well, I mean, I don't know. You failed to make your case in 4 years. What makes you think you're making your case now? You know, so he made the comment that the state has failed to prove its case in the last 4 years, but they engaged three out of four of the same experts they had before, and they submitted volumes of literature, essentially, that duplicate the literature already rejected in Bruin and Heller and McDonald and Citano. For one, they claim that states can restrict firearm use by anybody because, no, maybe it wasn't right to keep black people from having guns in 1868, but they did it, so it must be okay to do now. No, it was horrible to engage in racist lawmaking in the antebellum South, but they did do it, and so since they did it, it's okay to do it now. And then there was another one. This is a fabulous line of logic. Many states and local jurisdictions banned the use of, and this is not exactly true, by the way, but this is what the state claims. They banned the use of slugs, dirks, daggers, brass knuckles, spears, cane, sword canes, and, quote, pocket pistols. Well, that's not exactly true. They restricted the concealed carry of those items, typically. Some jurisdictions outlawed brass knuckles, but as was pointed out and rejected in Bruin, this same case, the very same case that the state keeps trotting out again and again and again, as was pointed out in Bruin before that line of logic was rejected, was that the Supreme Court has argued and issued the directive that all regulations must be analogous to firearm regulations at the time. Well, dirks, dugs, daggers, spears, and sword canes aren't firearms. So the fact that people ban those is absolutely and totally irrelevant to the situation. And then in Heller, the argument that you can reject, quote, pocket pistols was outright rejected by the court and then reaffirmed in Bruin. You can't reject pocket pistols. You cannot, because it is obvious and to anyone that the pistol is the most preferred form of self-defense in the United States today, far and away above everything else you could pick. Therefore, pistols are protected by the Second Amendment, period, full stop, as Mark Smith said, end of sentence. So the fact that some local jurisdictions and some states argued that you couldn't carry a pocket pistol, whoop, that's off the table. Because Heller and Bruin both affirm that the pistol is the most favored form of self-defense, and it is commonly possessed by lawful individuals for lawful purposes, and therefore is protected by the Second Amendment. So all of that logic that you can get rid of dirks, daggers, and brass knuckles and pocket pistols, and the pocket pistol is an aside, by the way, that's off the table. Can't use it. Doesn't count. Can't even be can't be considered in the court's logic. Then also, the court points out that, you know, it was very common to prohibit certain types of carry. And if you can prohibit certain types of carry, you can prohibit open carry. But that is a stretch that was also rejected by Heller and by Bruin specifically, because the type of carry that was regulated was concealed carry. And concealed carry wasn't ever banned. It was just regulated. You can only conceal carry if you were a traveler or if you this or if you that or if you some other thing. But it wasn't banned. And the open carry of a loaded weapon was never banned in 1791. And it wasn't banned throughout antebellum history, except in a few cases like Nundy, Georgia, which the Georgia Supreme Court rejected. And they said explicitly, you can ban concealed carry, but you can't ban open carry.
Wow.
So the fact that the state tried to ban or restrict or regulate certain types of carry, then here's what the state wants to do. They want to conflate that to public carry. That's what they call public carry.
Hey, Mark, we need to go off to our break real quick. Can we pick this up on the backside?
Sure.
Okay, great. Thank you. We're going to go off to our break real quick.
Don't try and take my guns away. You'll wish you hadn't, you'll be sorry. The worst mistake you'll ever make. Don't try and take my guns away. You think today's your lucky day? Better think it through before it's too late. Listen close to what I say. Don't try and take my guns away. You're in the land of the free. This is the home of the brave. And I ain't gonna be your slave. So don't try and take my guns away.
The Stillwater Powwow is back at the Redding Rodeo Grounds, October 6th through 8th, with free admission for all ages. See beautiful dancers, hear powerful drummers, and experience the celebration of Native American culture and history. Proudly brought to you by the Redding Rancheria and Winterville Resort and Casino. The Stillwater Powwow and the Redding Rodeo Grounds, October 6th through the 8th. For information, visit stillwaterpowwow.com. Brought to you by the Potters, this station, and other proud sponsors.
This is Judy Maxwell. Life can happen in an instant. Sometimes you plan for it, like retirement or taking care of your family. Sometimes it's a surprise, like a winter storm with home or property damage. Sometimes it may be an unexpected accident or illness or even a premature death. Whatever life throws at you, you'll wish you had gotten the right insurance when you had the chance. That's where Maxwell Insurance can help. For more than a quarter century, we've been serving the North State because it's our home, too. Give us a call at 221-0441 to let us help you review your policies and prepare you for whatever your future holds. Maxwell Insurance, 1378 Hilltop Drive, 221-0441.
Hey friends, please join us at Redding Civic Auditorium for the first annual Justice Crab Feed October 21st to raise money in the fight against human trafficking in Redding and abroad.
All proceeds go directly to Hard Places Community and Justice 180, both nonprofit organizations. Tickets are available at $75 each, or you can get a table sponsorship as well. For more information, go to justicecrabfeed@gmail.com or find us on Instagram at justicecrabfeed.
Yeah.
dream here in the North State. Okay, Mark, you still there, buddy?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay, good. Okay, let's resume that conversation a little bit. You were talking about the laws or restrictions that did not or that weren't happening or on the books, if you will, in 1791.
Yeah.
Were there any gun control laws, period?
No, there weren't. And Bruin also found, because, you know, this judge keeps insisting, Judge Mueller, I hate to even say her name, it just ruffles my feathers to even say her name, but anyway, this judge found that, you know, well, I need a historian to tell me what the Second Amendment means. Well, you're a judge. You're supposed to know what the Second Amendment means, and it's plain text, and it's in plain English, and so, you know, she allowed the state to get all these historians and stuff, and they went back to 1328 to the Statute of Northampton, and they went back to the Stephen Knight case, and they went back to 1689, the English Bill of Rights, where they were able to deny Catholics the right to carry guns, and therefore, even though that's racist and wrong, and it was the edict of a dictatorial king who we later fought a revolution, you know, a monarchy that we later fought a revolution with over their tyranny and kicked them out of our country. You know, since you could do that then, you could do it now. And that's really their take. Well, if you could do it then, you could do it now, no matter how weak their case was. But quite frankly, those standards were absolutely destroyed in Bruin, because the Bruin court took the Heller court took a fairly deep dive into history. There are hundreds of pages of history in the Heller court decision. And there are another 100 pages or so in the Bruin court decision. And when you look at those things, they rejected laws that were prior to the revolution because we fought a war against that guy in order to escape his tyranny. So why on earth would we accept his laws later? Yes, English common law does have a place in American history, but the dictatorial edicts of a crazy king do not. And that's why we fought him. And then, you know, the state tried the, they didn't know about mass violence then. Well, I mean, don't make me laugh. What was the Boston Massacre? That was mass violence where our own government shot at their own people.
Yeah.
Or look at the burning of Falmouth, Massachusetts. That was mass violence perpetrated on the people of that town by their own government. Look at the French and Indian Wars, where you'd come home from market or wherever you were to find your house burned down and your family dead in the yard. I mean, they were no strangers to mass violence. And then they said, well, you know, the state tried the argument, well, people really never did like guns and they never really carried them. Well, if that's the case, how did 70 men end up in Lexington Green on April 19, 1775, armed with their personal weapons, their personal equipment, to fight off a government that came to take their guns away from them? How did that occur? How did it occur later at an old North Bridge in Concord? And how did it occur even later when people of the colonies of the King of England chased their soldiers all the way back to Boston shooting at them with their own guns over that same tyranny? How could that possibly have happened if the state is correct in its analysis that people really hated guns and they never really carried them? I mean, those things are just so stupid they fly in the face of reality. And then even further, the Freedmen's Bureau in 1868 or 69, to affirm the 14th ratification of the 14th Amendment in 1868, said it's just ludicrous to think that freed blacks and freed slaves would not enjoy all of the rights of free Americans, including, and they specifically mentioned, including the right to keep and bear arms in any manner that they chose. And in the Dred Scott case, Justice Taney, who was kind of an old racist guy himself, you know, he said he could not give Dred Scott his freedom, because if he gave Dred Scott an escaped slave his freedom, then all black people would have the right to carry guns anywhere they wanted, just like all the rest of us. When you look at Thomas Jefferson's letters, let your gun be your constant companion. It's better exercise than any other game you could play. Andrew Jackson, much later than Jefferson, he was known to ride about with two pistols on his saddle, another one tucked in his belt, and a long gun slung over his shoulder everywhere he went. In 1861, Christopher Spencer walked up to the White House door with a repeating rifle. which would be akin to an assault weapon today. It's what the state calls an assault weapon. And he walks up to the door of the White House, knocks on the door, the guard opens, and he says, I want to see Abe Lincoln. And they say, oh, okay, come on in, with his loaded repeating rifle, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
They walk up to the president's office door, knock on the door. Abe says, come on in. Christopher Spencer goes in with a loaded repeating rifle, talks to old Abe about this gun. They go out in the backyard and they shoot it together out on the Capitol Mall. And they still have the target today. And by the way, Lincoln was not as good a shot as Spencer, although he wasn't familiar with a rifle. And they sat there and shot the gun together. Well, if public carry, if openly public carrying a loaded weapon was so reprehensible, how did any of that occur? How did any of it occur? And then the state trots out all the, California prohibited concealed carry in 1863. Yeah, they did. And then they repealed the law in 1870. And in 1901, a L.A. County sheriff wanted to ban the open carry of a loaded weapon, and that obviously didn't stand up because he was afraid that Mexicans would kill people in their beds. So that was a racially motivated law that never stood up. And in 1870, they repealed the concealed carry law. And then again in 1970, a Los Angeles County sheriff, he wanted to ban concealed carry because he thought Pancho Villa's men would sneak across the border with guns stuffed down their pants and murder Angelenos in their beds. So that was another racist way of keeping Mexicans from having guns. And that law actually stuck. That became the concealed carry law that we still have today. And the government has abused that time and time again. Well, why would you want to subject yourself to abuse when you have unregulated open carry? And that lasted in California from before the time that California was a state all the way up until 1968. So obviously, the state of California never had a problem with open carry. And how can the state then argue that there was always a problem with open carry when they didn't have a problem with it themselves?
So we had open carry, unregulated open carry, up until 1968.
In the state of California, it was not unlawful to openly carry a loaded weapon anywhere you wanted to go. And by the way, there was no such thing as a protected area or a special place, a sensitive place. I don't know what they call it now. The reason that we got open carry taken away from us is because the Black Panthers had a demonstration with loaded weapons inside the state capitol. So obviously there were no sensitive places in 1968 because they walked right in and nobody stopped them. And nobody tried to stop the protest until a state legislative aide accidentally, they wanted to know where the gallery was, the Senate gallery, and a legislative aide accidentally opened the door to the Senate floor itself. Well, once they found themselves in there, they kind of continued the protest. What else are you going to do?
Right.
And the fact that they were parading around among the desks with in obviously a fashion not meant to threaten anyone. I mean, weapons were pointed in the air. Nobody pointed a gun at anybody. I've seen video of it and pictures, and the muzzles were all straight up in the air. It was obviously a symbolic protest. But that was the opportunity that California's legislature needed to strip us all of our constitutional guarantee to self-defense. And they did it.
So this court
has affirmed that, and the courts in California have affirmed it time and time again. And now we have a challenge, and we are likely to succeed on the merits because there's one line in the Bruin case that's very important. And that is, if the conduct of the individual complies with the plain text of the Second Amendment, that conduct is presumptively constitutional, and it remains so unless the state can prove that a widely held, widely enforced regulation existed at the time the Second Amendment was written, and that would be the only way to delimit the boundaries of the Second Amendment. And so we have to go back to 1791, and when you go back there, there weren't any laws. There weren't any laws against carry concealed or open. There weren't any laws against any particular weapon. We had just fought a war. I mean, people could carry whatever they wanted, wherever they wanted, whenever they wanted, and that is the truth, and that's been upheld by Bruin as well. And in fact, Bruin said that none of the northern states had any meaningful gun regulation until well after 1870.
Okay, so now...
And that is outside the period that the court will allow for history that would regulate the Second Amendment.
Now, do they take into consideration other states, not the liberal states that we have, you know, California, Hawaii, Oregon, Washington, and Arizona, but other states that have open carry? Do they take into consideration how they handle it, what they do, like with their law enforcement, what their thoughts are on it, any of that information? Is the court going to take any of that into consideration?
No, it's not relevant because only history that's relevant, and even the Ninth Circuit, and the Ninth Circuit got this a little bit wrong. They're setting the time period for this relevant history as between 1791 and 1868, and that's not what the Supreme Court said. The Supreme Court said 1791 because they also said that when the 14th Amendment was ratified in 1868, it did not ratify a watered-down version of the Bill of Rights.
Okay.
It ratified the same Bill of Rights that the founders understood and recognized and enacted in 1791.
Okay.
So it's something that you have to look at very carefully to understand, but the history beyond 1791 is largely irrelevant. And also, the Bruin case said that the founders, they keep mentioning the founders. Well, the last founders were dead in 1725 or 1825. So beyond that, you couldn't know what the founders thought. So even if you stretch your imagination to its limit, the period of history that would be relevant would be between 1791 and 1825. And there were no meaningful gun regulations at all, anywhere, in any form whatsoever, except the antebellum South, where they had laws keeping black people from having guns without their master's permission.
Okay, so then...
And those are obviously rejected on racial grounds, and Bruin rejected them on racial grounds as well. They said something to the effect of, even if we considered this law, its racial motivation would take it out of the equation.
Okay, so then that cleans it up as far as all the garbage that they, being the government who was trying to take all the rights away, have muddied it up with. They're getting all that crap cleaned off of there so you can see what's actually down to the bone, 1791. So you're going to take the information from that time period, and that's what needs to stand. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay, so how hard is it for them to understand that? How hard is it for them to act on it? They're going to do everything they can to skirt it, correct?
Yes. I mean, look, it's hard for them to act on it because they don't want to.
Right,
I mean, they hate the fact that you have liberty. They hate the fact that I have liberty. They hate the fact that a tyrannical government can be opposed by the people who created that government to ensure their liberty and to make sure their liberty was maintained.
Aren't we supposed to change it if our government goes off the rails? Aren't we supposed to put it back on the rails? I mean, isn't that what the people are supposed to do? That was what the intent of the founders was?
That is the duty of the people, absolutely. And the price of liberty is eternal vigilance, and that's what we're doing in this case. We're calling out unconstitutional behavior not only on the part of the state of California, but on the part of the court, who obviously represents the state of California and should not. And this appellate court called them out on that. They said it is the duty of the judge to uphold the constitutional rights of the people. That is what the judge's duty is. And in the Moonlight case, the federal judge made a comment. It is the duty of the court to find justice, not just to win. I mean, you can win a case. You can win a case by all kinds of skullduggery. But that's not the duty of the court. The duty of the court is to find justice. The duty of this court is to uphold the constitutional rights of the people of the state of the Ninth Circuit, actually the 11 western states. And here's how that is to be done. When the conduct of the individual complies with the plain text of the Second Amendment, that conduct is presumptively constitutional unless the government can prove that there is a regulation that was widely held and widely supported in 1791 that opposes that conduct. Well, here's the problem for the state. If the founders wanted to prevent open carry of loaded weapons, they certainly could have. They had the pen in their hand. They had a blank piece of paper sitting in front of them. Instead of writing, "The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed," and then there's a prefatory clause, "a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state," that is the prefatory clause, and then the operative clause is this: in order to do number one, you have to be able to do number two, and that is the right of the people to keep, that means have, hold, have in your possession, keep in your home, and bear. And according to Bruin, bear comes from Muscarello v. U.S., and it's Ruth Bader Ginsburg said this, a liberal judge said this. Bear means to wear, bear, or carry on your person, in your pocket, or in your clothing, any instrument capable of offensive or defensive use in the event of conflict with another person. In other words, carry it about. And Justice Thomas said he doubted very seriously that meant to put on a holster so you could carry your gun from your bedroom to your bathroom. Carry applies outside the home. Keep is inside the home. Bear is outside the home, in public spaces, on your person, in your pocket, or in your clothing, any instrument capable of offensive or defensive use in the event of conflict with another person. Well, that kind of stitches it up for me. So there were no regulations against concealed carry. Now, Bruin was a concealed carry case. They did not specifically answer open carry questions because that wasn't the question before them. The question before them was, can New York restrict concealed carry ostensibly so that no one could do it? And that's what it boiled. That's a long, you know, that was a long case, but that boils it down to one sentence. And the answer to that was no. In Bruin, if a person passes the background check and jumps through the hoops, limited amounts of hoops dated by law, then they shall be issued a permit to carry a weapon concealed. But Bruin did not answer whether open carry was lawful or unlawful. However, Bruin did pose a test through which further Second Amendment cases should be adjudicated. And that's if the plain text covers the behavior. And clearly, our case requests behavior, requests the legitimizing of behavior that is the plain text verbatim of the Second Amendment. The right to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. That means no permission. That means you put your gun on and you go about peacefully carrying your weapon for the purposes of self-defense.
Okay. Well, so then, with the justice being blind, we should be able to obtain this. This should be presented to the public, and this should just be rolled out by the courts, and everything should be hunky-dory. Now, in reality, we know that justice delayed is justice denied, and that is Judge Mueller's M.O. She is going to deny it all the way to the end, as far as she can. In my mind, that's the way I see it. So what is your realistic timeline on this occurring? What do you think is really going to happen?
Well, that's a tough one, but we do have a hearing on November the 3rd because the state, they kind of made a little procedural error in my case. They, before PI was ruled on by the Ninth Circuit and remanded and reversed, they had asked for a summary judgment, and here's what a summary judgment is. It is all the paperwork has been submitted, all the history has been submitted, all, you know, the facts are in evidence, no one has any argument about the facts, they're all there. We want you to rule in our favor. Well, we cross-motioned for the same thing. All the facts are in evidence, there is no argument about the evidence, it's all there, there's no more history to discover, no nothing, and we want you to rule in our favor. The plaintiff's favor to openly carry weapons. So that hearing is on November 3rd. Well, since then, the Ninth Circuit has spanked Judge Mueller because she has not been using the correct law to determine the outcome of this case. and she needs to change the type of law that she uses to determine the outcome of this case. And that law definitely favors our side. So I for one, and what we need to do is we need to somehow, the filing itself is pretty clear, but we need to get the Duncan case history, where they refute the history of the state out of the Duncan magazine case. We need to get that on the record, because that could be very germane to the outcome, where Bruin flatly rejected lumping pistols in with knives and dirks and Bowie knives, and where they flatly rejected law post-1868, and where they flatly rejected racially motivated laws, because that leaves no laws whatsoever. And in Bruin, the Bruin case says that the state proved nothing, that northern states had no firearms laws that were germane or applicable, and that the only laws that southern states had were racially motivated, and therefore those aren't applicable. And basically, there were no restrictive gun laws between 1791 and 1848 that could be used to deny people their Second Amendment guarantees. There were none. And the Bruin case says that. So we need to make sure that's on the record. And also, we need to get something else in the record that the Ninth Circuit was very careful to state, and that is that California is making the case that they have to have a permit, because elsewise they can't determine who is a law-abiding citizen from who is a criminal and who might be carrying a weapon. But they have never entered any evidence whatsoever to show that if you have a weapon, you're not a law-abiding citizen. In other words, they have no statistics. They have no, there is no question that has ever been raised by the state to suggest that the entirety of the state of California are criminals unless the state proves otherwise. Wow. There has been no evidence put forth to suggest that, none whatsoever.
Well,
so we need to get that on the record, that the question itself is flawed. In other words, the fact that I don't pass a background check doesn't make me a criminal.
Right. Now, I just ran up looking at the calendar. There's 40 days until November 3rd. So you were saying between immediate and 60 days, given the calendar dates that were used before, so you're right in there. So if she continues to use that date, would that summary judgment hearing be used for that?
Well, that's what, I mean, she certainly could do that. But because this was filed September 7th, so November 7th would be the drop-dead date on the 60 days.
Uh-huh.
Now, if she issues a summary judgment, that would make the preliminary injunction moot. But what we're going to try to do is we're going to try to force the reissuance of that preliminary injunction prior to that November 3rd date. And we may file a writ of mandamus. You know, I don't know what form that'll take. But what we're going to try to do is force her to act before she wants to.
Okay.
And because she'll make procedural errors, she can't help herself. It's her deal. And the state will make errors because they don't really have any evidence. And they don't. I mean, if you know, one thing the court really spanked her for is she intentionally failed to look at our possibility of success on the merits of the case. She said, well, I don't have to. This is preliminary. Well, that's what a preliminary injunction is supposed to settle. So you would kind of think that all four of those bars would apply no matter when. But anyway, that was her argument. And here's what my conjecture is. If the state had evidence that they could prove that we were not likely to succeed on the merits, would they not have used it?
Right.
So they obviously have no evidence that we would fail on the merits of the case, or they would have used it.
They would have rubbed your face in it, yeah.
They would have rubbed our nose in it 50 ways from nowhere and laughed about it all the way back to the office.
Yeah.
They had no such evidence. They failed to use it. They went straight to public safety. Well, public safety demands that you get a background check and you get fingerprinted. So what they're doing...
Hey, Mark, we're getting cut off now. I'm so sorry.
Come out and play. Have you seen the bill? We all have to pay. It's not our bill. We had no say. You don't serve us. You serve LA.
time has come for 51 in a Jefferson state of mind.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.